I'm Dr. Emily Silverman, and welcome to Talking Dementia with Remo Health. Join us as we explore the latest advances, insights, and strategies that help empower those living with dementia and the families that support them. Each episode, we sit down with leading experts, from physicians and researchers to policymakers and clinicians, to provide you with the resources needed to navigate this complex disease. Today, we're speaking with Anne Basting. Anne Basting, PhD, is a scholar, writer, and advocate for creative aging. She is a professor emeritus of theater at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and the founder of Time Slips, a nonprofit organization that promotes creative storytelling as a means of engaging people with dementia. In her book, Creative Care, she challenges traditional dementia care by shifting the focus from memory loss to imagination and meaningful connection. A MacArthur Fellow, Basting's innovative approach has transformed how we engage with aging and promoted the fostering of dignity and joy through the arts. Anne, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's great to be here.
So Anne, you have over 25 years of experience doing this work, working with elders, working with people who have dementia, using the arts and storytelling and creativity and improvisation to help bring joy and care to this group of people. But before we get to some of the lessons or takeaways of your work, let's rewind to the beginning. Tell us about 25 years ago, what initially drew you to this work and specifically working with older people and people with dementia?
I like to start when I answer that question by saying it's perfectly normal for a 25-year-old to want to do a PhD about theatrical and everyday life representations of aging. Because why wouldn't you want to focus on what's ahead and 50 years of the life course? There's always something behind that question that's a little bit like, it's not normal for people to be interested in this. So what is that explanation? But then there is always an interesting story. So I would say that I was one of those kids growing up that did not understand my peers as well as I understood people older than me. So I often found myself in the company of people much older. When I was in seventh grade, my mother put me in art classes. I think I was 12, and everyone else was in their 40s and 50s. I was just super comfortable making art with older people. I did have a good relationship with my grandmother. I didn't see her all that often, but I was a fiction writer and wrote older characters. And that was powerful for me until I started writing plays. And then suddenly it was a problem. I would have a play reading and people would say, "We love this play, but there's no actors for a play about four women in their 90s in a nursing home and their friendship." And I'm like, "Really?" And that really compelled my research on the theatrical representations. I did a master's in theater and then a PhD in theater and followed around senior theater groups around the country, which have blossomed. I mean, there are so many now, you can't count them. And then I think when I was turning the dissertation into a book, I just wanted to see if all of this powerful theater games and the essence of creating theater, playing a new role, could be as transformative with people with profound disabilities as it was for these healthy older adults that I saw in senior theater. And then I just started volunteering in a nursing home on an Alzheimer's unit. That was 1996 and really has just compelled my work ever since, really stumbling into the miracle of improvisation and its power to relieve the pressure or the expectation of memory and invite the expression of imagination just completely transformed the dynamics in the relationship and what was possible. And once you feel that, you really can't stop doing it. It's not really possible.
I think a lot of people, when they think about times they have visited nursing homes, the images that they have in their head are stuffy rooms, people sitting in chairs, maybe some of them are nodding off. Maybe there's games that are happening, but the games are passive, like maybe it's bingo or something. A lot of the people sit and watch TV and zone out in front of the TV. And these are the activities that we think of in the garden variety, ordinary nursing home. Talk to us about why that's so limiting and the difference between your approach and that approach and why you think we are where we are and where we could go.
It's a big question, and it encapsulates 30 years of work, because that first nursing home that I went to as a volunteer, just practicing these theater techniques, was exactly that. I vividly remember having to force myself over the threshold through the smells. It was not a very good place, not a place that invited you in to experience meaningful connection with people. And I think that activities, quote unquote, have really been framed as something to do onto another person rather than as something to create meaningful engagement and connection between people. Our healthcare system is really about treatment on the person and not really about the relational dynamics. And in a situation like dementia, where one's identity is, let me just say, always relational, but in situations of dementia and cognitive challenges and profound physical disabilities, that relationality is more pronounced. It's present. And so much of what we need to do in care with people experiencing dementia is activate that relationality. I think that's where we go wrong. If you look at the arc of what I've done, I started just with that improvisational technique and then figuring out how to teach it to anyone. Watch out, I'll try to teach you, right? Like any human being can learn this technique. Then trying to teach it to people in different care settings. And then trying to accumulate the approach inside of a care setting to transform that setting into a place that feels like people are literally just waiting to die and activities are just disrupting that overarching feeling into a place where meaning and beauty can be made and experienced every day. And that, to me, is the transformative potential of quote unquote activities. But those activities are successful if they are infused into the whole care system so that it becomes the way of being with each other rather than now we're going to go out and do this thing and then come back in and you're going to sit in your room in front of the television for hours. It has to be poured into the water.
There's a scene in your book I'd love for you to dig into for a moment for the audience, because they may not be familiar with your work. And the scene is you go to a group where there's a bunch of elders and you embark on this process of constructing a character. Like, who should this person be? Is it a man? Is it a woman? What's their name? What's their job? And everybody's shouting things out. It kind of reminded me of going to an improv show where they say, shout out a word. And then everyone...
That's exactly what it is.
...builds on it. So tell us about that exercise and help us understand why that's generative and why that gets people participating and exciting in a way that's just so different from bingo or watching TV.
Sure. So you're referencing the core of what's been called the time slips methodology. That's that thing that I fell into and that felt like a miracle. And then I've spent so much time trying to hone it as a process to be able to explain it to other people. So I'll give it my best shot. There's basically a three-part communication loop. It starts with what I've come to call a beautiful question, which is a question that just opens up discovery. There's no right or wrong answer. It just opens up discovery. Some people call it an open-ended question. It's not yes or no. There's no right or wrong. It also invites, I think, a little bit of wonder about the world around you. People are so used to certain kinds of questions. I like to say that the beautiful question helps you jump the track of what's expected from you and makes you reconsider. And then it's followed by yes and, which is the core of improvisation. It's only 2-3-letter words, but it's so radically transformative, particularly in a health setting. It means that you're accepting everything that's given to you in the moment, which can be profound disability from a person that you love deeply and are trying to protect and put back together through a process that can feel like they're dissolving in front of you. So it's hard to accept where that person is in the moment. Observing everything that they're using to communicate with you and then adding something to it that's positive. I like to say yes and, not yes but. You're not correcting. You're really just building on what's given to you. And then the third one is what I've come to call proof of listening, which is a way to show the person that they've been heard. Sometimes, especially in dementia, when you're having cognitive intake challenges, I'll put it that way, you have to do it in multiple ways. So you can write down the person's words or echo them back and be open to being corrected so that the person knows that you're really understanding what they're saying. You can use your face to echo the emotion, whatever tools you have to echo and show the person that they've been heard. So it's beautiful question, yes, and proof of listening. And to give an example of what does that look like in practice? So the story, it was such a miracle. I just tell it over and over, is really the first one that you were talking about. You start with a prompt, which is really anything in those first sessions. I just tore a picture out of a magazine that was kind of iconic. I happened to pull the Marlboro Man, iconic cowboy hat profile. And I just said, what do you want to call him? And that is an example of an open, beautiful question. It's giving the creative control to the other person and reminding them in the question that they have that creative control. So what do you want to call him? And someone said, Fred. And I said, Fred, is that right? Yes, that's right. Fred who? Fred Astaire. So we had a cowboy named Fred Astaire. And where do you want to say this takes place? Someone said Oklahoma. And then someone started to sing, Oklahoma, where the wind goes sweeping down the plain. And we all did it together. And we all laughed. And I said, okay. Then you start the repetition. There's little waves of story that gets built. And the magic is that you're always repeating it so that the person feels like they have the whole story. Because wherever they are in the short-term memory loss, if you don't repeat the story, they might not remember what they've built so far. So you just repeat it. So we had Fred Astaire, who lived in Oklahoma. Oklahoma, where the wind goes sweeping down the plain. What does Oklahoma look like? There are a lot of skinny rivers and skinny trees, which I just loved. Does he have a family? Yes, he does. He has a family. He's married to Gina Autry. They both ride the rodeo. She's better than he is. So they do different events. He does the calf roping and she did the barrel riding. It went on for 45 minutes. I would just repeat it every now and then to get them back to the moment of creativity where we would add to it. And then you sort of feel like, I think we're kind of done. We've explored all past, present, future of this moment and the characters. And should we finish it? Yeah. And what do you want to call it? And then we're done. And it's a beautiful thing that you have that is filled with joy and laughter and sometimes sorrow and sometimes regret and sometimes dreams. And they're just beautiful.
There was a story in your book, maybe it wasn't a story, maybe it was a hypothetical, but it was something along these lines where, let's say there's an older man with dementia and his wife died 10 years ago and he doesn't remember that she died and he's with his daughter and he says to his daughter, "When's my wife coming home?" And the daughter freezes. She doesn't know what to say. And so one option is the daughter can lie. She can say, "Oh, mom will be home in 5 minutes," which is not true. Another option is she can repeat again and again, "Daddy, mom's dead. Daddy, mommy died." And that doesn't feel good either. And then there's a third way, which is more generative, which is something along the lines of, "Well, if mom were here, what would we do together?" More of that beautiful question. And ever since I read that, I've actually been trying it with my toddler. I know that toddlers and
they're very different.
People with dementia are very different. But if we're in the car and she's upset because she wants to go to the ice cream store, instead of saying yes or no, or maybe I'll just say, "Well, what flavor would you get? What toppings would you get?" And it is, I find a way to kind of get to a different place in the conversation. So I was just wondering if you could talk about beautiful questions and improv. And the first example that you shared was more coming into a space and doing it as an activity, but weaving it into these moments in life.
Sure. And there is actually at timeslips.org and also now at Dementia Friendly America, Timeslips has a free 45-minute, really beautifully designed training that's designed for family and friends and shares exactly this, the core principles, and then how to integrate it into specific moments of care. And I think also Dr. Jason Karlowish, who is at the Penn Memory Center, actually wrote an article, I can't remember if it was in Stat or Lancet, that he calls it the creative option, that you don't have to use quote unquote therapeutic lying or the white lie, the cold truth, the white lie, or the third approach of the creative care approach, which is to follow the feeling and the curiosity, to turn it into wonder. An example would be exactly what you said. Tell me what you miss about mom. When you think of mom, what do you think of? Let's write a little poem about her. I like to say, get in touch with your inner terrible drawer. I've been doing it a lot now. I have a Substack and I'm illustrating my own essays and I'm just bad. But it doesn't matter because it captures the emotion of the moment. You can create a little story. You can supply your favorite memory. Memories should always be offered as gifts and not tests. So it's not, "Do you remember?" It's, "I remember," and it's a gift. So it really unlocks that third approach. I'd say another really clear micro moment is when someone gets frustrated because they can't think of a word. And we pulled this actually from a real life story that came to us when a woman with dementia wanted the ketchup and was really frustrated. And instead of supplying the word, the daughter said, "What do you want to call it? We'll just call it whatever you want to call it." Mm-hmm. And she said, "Red sauce." Mm-hmm. Well, that's perfectly logical. Don't fret about not being able to get the word. Let us call it red sauce until the next time and you decide it's ketchup again, you know. So it just relieves the pressure on the moment in a world that is ruled by the expectation of rational language and chronology. It just loosens the edges that make those moments a little more connective.
I don't want to romanticize dementia in any way. And we had a beautiful story on the podcast several months ago. It was a woman describing going for a walk with her husband, and he was the one living with dementia. And she was very sad that day. She was in a sad mood. And they're walking together, and at one point, he turns to her and he says, "Why are you raining?" And as she was telling us that story, she started tearing up. And you could tell that she thought there was something beautiful there, something obviously metaphorical there about the question. And I'm not sure why he said it that way. I'm not sure if there was a word that he was reaching for that he couldn't find. And so instead he opted for, "Why are you raining?" But I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about brains that are sick with dementia and what they offer creatively that a healthy brain may not be able to offer.
The simplest way to describe it is that people with cognitive challenges like dementia are living in poetry. Poetry is metaphoric language. If you can't come up with one word or a concept, you have to reach for another one already that's metaphor or simile. And so they open up our understanding of the world by communicating in poetry. And that example you gave is a really beautiful example of that. But it's my pretty common experience. And sometimes they won't be words at all. They'll be sounds or gestures, depending on if the person is beyond language, either in that moment or in that phase of wherever they are. It's teaching us to open how we think about communication and how we interpret the world. I'll add a little story to that, which is, I don't know if people have seen the movie Away From Her. It's based on an Alice Munro story, The Bear Went Over the Mountain. And it's a story of a woman experiencing dementia. And before she moves into supportive care environment, she is taking a walk with her husband. And her face is just filled with wonder and light. And he says, "What is it?" And she said, "I look away and I look back and yellow is new again." She's looking at a flower that's yellow. You don't want to romanticize it because it is hard. It is really hard. But it also is filled with these little openings that can deepen our understanding of what it means to be alive and to perceive.
You talked earlier about relationality and just now about communication. You also spoke earlier about how using this more improvisational approach can de-escalate situations in a way. It blunts the edges. It removes the expectation. Do you remember? You know, that becomes a test. Memories should be gifts. They shouldn't be tests. I was just wondering if you could open up that a little bit more for us and talk about how this approach can affect the relationships between the person living with dementia and their loved one or their caregiver and their family. There's so much pain and so much difficulty with communication. There's behavioral issues that come up. Things get lost in translation. Have you found that this approach does help de-escalate some of that pain or tension or difficulty inside the home or inside the relationship?
I do think it eases some of the pain of it. And it's because when you're engaging in the process of shared co-creation, of making the moment into something, you're basically creating a new experience or a little piece of art, whether it's theater, which is ephemeral and you don't capture it in any way, or you're making a poem or a piece of art together. The creative process reduces stress in and of itself. You enter into what Mahay Csikszentmihalyi has called the flow state, which boosts your immune system, we know from research, and also reduces stress. And it gives you a way to stop fighting the changes and embrace the moment. I also think that there are large organizations that try to teach you how to be in the moment. And when you really fully enter it, this experience of care and this framework of care is really being in the moment and treasuring what's right in front of you. Caregivers are also battling. I mean, my mother has dementia now, so I'm fully in it as well. And you're experiencing what they call anticipatory grief, where the person is in front of you. They aren't gone yet, but you're holding the memory of what the person was like. In some ways, it's almost overwhelming, the impulse to try to repair and fill in the gap between who they were and who they are, or protect it. And I've seen that especially with children or spouses of men who were very powerful and dignified. I don't want them dancing in the care home. It's just not what they ever would have done. But you're denying a person an expression in the moment that is just transformative. And is it that you're protecting who they were, but you're also then losing the opportunity to really connect with them in the moment and to share in an emotional experience? So I think figuring out how to understand anticipatory loss and understand that that temptation to protect and rebuild, the way I describe it is, if you keep building up these blocks of who they were, you end up with a nice brick wall between you and the person. And it really sort of blocks off any current emotional connection. And so to release that temptation and to get curious, who is the person right in front of me today? I have this thing where I walk into my mom's room and I say, hoo-hoo. And if she answers, hoo-hoo, I'll know something about her presence that day, if she's having a hard day or not. There might be music that you can share and just listen to and sway together in the moment. Really, the research on music and dementia is probably the strongest of any of the arts. But just sharing the present moment, experiencing those things, can relieve a lot of the sorrow. What you're really grieving is the connection. I think finding a way toward the deep connection is the best way to heal that sorrow.
And what about the stigma against dementia? It's a word I think that people sometimes struggle to even say. They don't want people to know. It's different from cancer. So how might this work, or is it already, do you think, helping reduce the stigma of dementia in society?
I have done a lot of thinking about what I call the iatrogenic effects, because sometimes I would go into care settings and I'm like, I can't tell if this is a symptom of the drugs that they're using to treat the person or to deaden the person's awareness of their environment, unstimulating environment, or is it a symptom of dementia? Is it a symptom of we don't have enough care workers? You can't tell. And if you enliven the environment, you can see a dramatic transformation. Another part of my way into this as a college professor for many, many years was teaching service learning students across a shocking number of disciplines, from the arts and English to psychology and theology and nursing and social work, to the improvisational engagement technique, and to go into the care homes or one-on-one settings and just be in company, guide a storytelling session in a group or one-on-one. And as in the professions, there aren't enough geriatric social workers, there aren't enough geriatricians, there aren't enough nurses that are trained in geriatrics because of the stigma of I want to help kids. The presumed joyfulness of helping kids, which honestly is not always, it's not always just joyful. It can also bring its own challenges. And my mission was really to create a framework and tools that would bring these volunteers and these service learning students into these settings that they really were scared of because of the stigma and the presumed stereotypes, and just being gobsmacked by how joyful and fun it was. One of my favorite stories of that was a student in one of my classes who came up to me and said, you know, this morning I was really down. I have tests coming up and I'm just not prepared and I have to work and I don't have enough time. And then I thought, oh, I get to be with people with dementia today. And she was so happy. She was like, that's just going to reset my mood. And I thought, well, that is what we need, for people to realize that this can be joyful and connective. It doesn't have to be depressing. It's not that it's easy. People are at the end of their lives, but that's the human experience. Because someone's near the end of their lives, are we going to abandon them? That's what the stigma is leading us to. So I think we really do need to invest in messaging that this can be really powerful and joyful. Some of the work I'm doing with memory cafes is really getting to that right now. We're in the midst of a public awareness campaign to grow memory cafes tenfold in 10 years, because we should always be really ambitious. And memory cafes are just social gatherings where people with dementia and a care partner, or if they want to go alone, they can go alone. It's designed for respite together, is a good way to say it. You can find friendship and joy and meaningful social programming. And everyone should have a memory cafe within driving distance. We're getting there, but we're trying to spread it. And the video that we have is just full of dancing and laughter. Those sessions are just euphoric because people are just happy to be together.
Looking ahead at the next 10, 20 years, what do you see or what would you like to see? How should dementia care evolve?
It's a big question, and it's fraught in the moment that we're recording this with a lot of instability about the infrastructures that have done somewhat of a good job propping up care, but with a lot of room for improvement. And now even that system is in jeopardy, which is really scary. I think the memory cafe movement is a big answer. I think there should be 10,000 memory cafes across the United States. Every library, every congregation, every arts and culture organization, any place where people gather, YMCAs. If you think of it akin to the homeschool movement, when kids were starting to get homeschooled and then they invented a whole social network for kids who were being homeschooled to come together. If you think about the 85% of people with dementia and a caregiver who are living at home, not in residential care settings, they need that same infrastructure for gathering and friendship and shared experience. So I really would imagine a vibrant network. And we have a directory now capturing all the existing ones called memorycafedirectory.com. I think, too, that the way in, it is very difficult to, in residential care settings or even home care, to find and train staff. I think those care workers should get health care. I think that is just a human right at this point, that if you're relationally protecting the care of another human being, you should have health care coverage. I also think that because we don't have enough people to provide care, that we should really be boosting the volunteer and service learning components from high school and colleges, and also from retirees, to be part of the solution for meaningful engagement in residential care settings and home care settings. TimeSlips is switching to a train-the-trainer program so that we can really get these approaches out there, and then figuring out which systems to run these frameworks and trainings through so that they can really just start expanding and offering it as part of the solution.
Well, that feels very concrete and doable, actually.
Like doesn't
memory
it,
cafes, training the trainer. And so that leaves me feeling hopeful and inspired. And I'm wondering, as we draw this to a close, if there's anything else you'd like to share with the Remo audience.
I often tell people to have confidence in their own creativity, that every human being is creative.
feeling that creativity is really powerful for everyone. And then you can't invite another person into creativity until you feel that yourself. And it's also really good to challenge your own brain, and the shift toward brain health is really powerful as well now and in 10 years. I've also started following my own advice, and I have a Substack where I've been creating little videos and creating prompts and short essays, and then illustrating those essays as a way to say, look, everybody can do this. Grow a little bit yourself. Try it. Just try some form of expression. And I'm trying to model opening up moments into wonder in that way. So I think I just leave it with try it. Experiment. Turn toward the curious. Turn toward the moment of wonder. And think about how you could connect in the moment. People have instrumental tasks they have to get done, but try to do them playfully and make them into creativity instead, so that you're doing them together.
I have been speaking with the wonderful Anne Basting. Anne is a scholar, writer, and advocate for creative aging. And we're just so thrilled to have had you on the show today. This has been really, really wonderful. So Anne, thanks again for coming on.
It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening. For more information about this episode, check out the links and resources listed in the show notes. If you're interested in learning more from Remo, visit us at www.remo.health. Take care.